And here we go. Welcome to Greek Club at Concordia Seminary. The faculty typically calls this High Motivation Week because this is the week after call day and vicarage assignments. And so nobody wants to be here except, A, the people who live here and the first-year students. What a surprise. The only students here today are first-year students and other faithful friends. That's right. So we are happy to be here, and we're happy that the Bible was written, at least part of it, in Greek, and we are in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, and I'm pretty sure that we are at verse 3. Again, with 10:1, the sort of the tone of the letter takes a discernible shift. Paul becomes more, I was going to say defensive, but that's not right. He's actually more on the offense. And becoming more stern, presumably towards those in Corinth who still might be questioning his authority and his message. So in verse 2, he actually has said something like, "I beseech that I might not, when I am present, be bold with the confidence with which I reckon to dare." And then a P plus the accusative probably here, against certain ones who reckon us as those who walk according to the flesh. That's verse 2 of chapter 10. And then he explains that in verse 3. And maybe we'll get 3. Well, actually, we'll get 3 and part of 4 because the grammar here is a little bit difficult. But we're thankful for the commas, actually, is what we are. So it would sound something like this: En sarkigar peripatuntes ou katasarka stratiomatha. Tagar hapla te strateas hemon ou sarkika ala dinatato theo pros kath irisen achuromaton, comma, and we'll stop there. Paul says, for, and the participle peripatuntes. Again, it's masculine plural nominative. The referent would be the we of the verb that comes along 4 words later. We are waging war. Woodenly, it would be for walking in the flesh. And it might actually have a concessive force here. So translate, even though we are walking in the flesh, we are not waging war according to the flesh. So Paul is kind of playing with some words here, and especially with kind of the theological meaning of flesh. He's also playing with, as we'll see, with what they're saying about what he's like when he writes letters and what he's like when he's physically present. So although we are walking in the flesh, which presumably means in our physical being, we are not waging war according to the flesh. And then we have a kind of a parenthetical comment. For the hapla, the weapons of our warfare, our battling. Now, no verb, so we just supply the linking verb. U sarkika are not fleshly. Rather, repeat the supplied verb. They are powerful in relation to God, or powerful because of God, or something like that. And what are they for? Pros plus the accusative. They are for the kathairesis. This is from kathaireo, which means to tear down. For the tearing down of... I didn't look it up, but I'm pretty sure this word is used only once in the New Testament. It means fortresses. An ohirama. An ochiroma is a fortress, for the tearing down of fortresses. Now, notice the editors have given us a comma there, and that's a clue. I had to have help to figure this out, because we get a participle here. We get lagesmus kath iruntes. The participle is masculine plural nominative. So what's it connected to? And the answer, or at least one answer, is back up to the verb stratuomatha at the end of verse 3. So if we take most of verse 4 as kind of a parenthetical comment, then we can pick up the rest of the sentence and actually then run 1, to three participles all the way to the end of verse 6. And so the main verb in this long sentence would simply be the stratiometha, we are waging war, right? So, and that's the way it would run. But at least initially, it's not too hard. Any questions about verses 3 and part of 4? Anything? All right. Well, let's keep going there, and I'll read the very end of verse 4. And then 5. Should we get 5 and 6? Let's do the whole thing, and I'll try to emphasize the participles as I read. So, logismus kath iruntes, kai pan hipsoma, ep iramenon, katates gnosis tu theu, kai eich malo tidzontes, pan naima, eistein hippakoein tu Christu, kai en hetoimo ekantes, ek dikesai pazan parakoein, hatan klerothe, plerothe humon, he hippakoe. So again, we are waging war. Now, participle 1 is at the very end of verse 4. Is this expressing manner? Maybe. This is how we're waging war, by tearing down reasonings, presumably hostile thoughts, logismuses, right? Let's take it that way. By tearing down reasonings, arguments, maybe, and not only tearing them down, but also every hypsoma. You can kind of spot the basic meaning of this. Hypsao means, you know, I lift up or I exalt. And here the dictionary suggests arrogance as the meaning for hypsoma. Arrogance. Now, what kind of arrogance, modified by this participle, which is from ep iro, which means to lift up or raise up, and we'll parse it as ep iramenon, as a present participle passive, neuter singular accusative. So we're tearing down arguments, and every arrogance, take it as attributive, adjectival, which is being lifted up. Now, kata plus the genitive can mean down, or it also means against. Every arrogance which is being lifted up against the knowledge of God. And that would be a good example of an objective genitive, knowing God. Everything that prevents you or subverts the believers, knowing God. So all of that, to that comma, goes with kath iruntes, that participle. So in a sense, we have two direct objects of the participle, logismus and pan hipsoma. Two accusatives, okay? And then another participle. And now eich malo tidzo means to take captive. And eich malotes is a captive. This is the word, I think it's in Ephesians, where Christ ascends on high and leads captivity captive, I think. And how are we waging war? Second participle now. By taking captive, pan noema, every thought. And why are we taking it captive? Eistein hippakoein, for or unto the obedience of Christ. Again, probably another objective genitive, in order that every thought might obey Christ. So that one's a little easier. Just, again, another participle. The we wage war is the referent to the participle, and pan naima is the direct object of it. And then the ace prepositional phrase modifies the participle. And then now, verse 6 is mostly a third participle construction, right? And this is a little bit of an idiom. I had to look this up. I thought I might have guessed what it meant, but I looked it up. To have in readiness, or to have in a ready thing, easily enough means to be ready. And by having in readiness, and by being ready to do something, ek de kesai, This is from ek de ke'o, and this would be the weak aorist infinitive active, and it means to judge or, in a negative sense, punish, and maybe that's what it means here. By being ready to punish every disobedience, pasan para koe. And when is this the case? Now, hatan plus the subjunctive. Remember that hatan is just when, hate, plus on, right? And refers to the future. Whenever, and now the verb of this, the subject of the verb is obedience, he, hipakoe. And the verb is an aorist subjunctive passive from my great friend, pleirao. I say my great friend because Matthew loves this verb. Whenever your obedience, the obedience of you, that would be, by the way, a subjective genitive, right? Because you, Paul wants you, Corinthians, to be the ones who are hippakuoing, right? Whenever your obedience is fulfilled. So, going back and doing that whole sentence again, it starts at verse 3. For although we are walking in the flesh, we are not waging war according to the flesh. Parenthesis. For the weapons of our warfare are not fleshly, but powerful in respect to God for the tearing down of fortresses. Close parenthesis. We are waging war by tearing down debates and every arrogance lifted up against the knowledge of God, and by taking captive every thought for the obedience of Christ, and by being ready to judge or punish every disobedience whenever your obedience is fulfilled. And see here, week after week, we were saying Paul is writing nice short sentences and it's all good, and this is a little longer. So, questions, comments? Bill?
I had a problem with the translation of the obedience of Christ as objective.
Mm-hmm.
You say, because in English we never refer to obedience as belonging to anything but the person who is being obedient.
Right.
So, but in Greek they do it.
In Greek you can do it, exactly. Yeah, you can. The obedience of X can be what X is doing.
Not obedient to, but obedient.
Exactly, or it can be, just as you said it, and probably that's the way the English translations gloss it, obedience to Christ, now that I think about it. But, yeah. The most famous example of this, of course, is the so-called pistis Jesu debate, which you're somewhat familiar with. Is this faith in Jesus, or is this faithfulness of Jesus? Jesus being faithful. And the right answer is what I think, which... clearly. And by the way, when somebody doesn't have any evidence, they say clearly. You know, clearly. The Germans say natürlich. So,
clearly.
So, yeah, good. But you're right, it does strike an English speaker's ear odd.
Well, so how do you take that, though? Is it 2:16?
Yeah, it's, and in Romans 1 and 3 and so forth, yeah, I think it's an objective genitive. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's anything wrong doctrinally with the subjective genitive. Mm-hmm. But Paul never overtly calls Jesus faithful. He never does it, ever. God is faithful occasionally in Paul. And he never, ever makes Jesus the subject of the verb pisteuo.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas believers are subject of the verb pisteuo constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So yeah, if Paul were going to say that Christ is faithful, this is certainly a difficult way of doing it. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I do think that faith in Jesus is at least almost all the time. There's one or two passages where faithfulness of Jesus might make more sense. But
sounds pretty clear to me.
Yeah, well, it is pretty clear. Yeah, yeah. There's this great footnote in Stephen Westerholm's book, Perspectives Old and New in Paul, in which it's like a two-page footnote or something, and he says, "I have no objections to the subjective genitive, other than that it's wrong." Yeah. Yeah, so. Good. Okay, objectives and subjective genitives. It doesn't get any better than that. Yeah, that's right. Other comments on these verses? Okay, good. All right, we'll get verse 7 then. Ta kata prosopon blepeta. Etis pepoi then ha auto Christu enai. tuta logetzesto palen fhautu, huti kathos autos Christu, hutos kai hemes. Blepita there at the beginning could be an indicative, but I think it's normally, I guess it is normally taken as an indicative. It could be an imperative. See the things according to face. But I think it's taken more as an indicative, which is sort of an accusation. You are looking at, in a sense, the things according to face probably means something like outward realities or something like that. And, of course, he's trying to get them to see things differently, right? So, and again, the ta there, the article at the beginning, simply takes over the prepositional phrase and turns it into a noun, right? As you know, Greek can do this. German can do this as well, probably other languages. Hebrew typically doesn't do this. Yeah, right. So, which is one of the many reasons to like Hebrew, right? So,
thank you very much.
Yeah, that's right. No problem. So, you are looking at outward things. If someone is confident, pepoithen, this is the perfect active of patho, which means I persuade. And oddly enough, the strong perfect comes to have the meaning of to trust or be confident. Okay, and it's fairly common in the New Testament. If someone, tis, is confident in himself, and what is he confident about? To be of Christ, right? This would be an infinitive of indirect discourse. And it's typically translated as if it were a huti clause. If someone is confident that in himself, that he is Christ's, that he belongs to Christ. So if that's the case, that's the if clause. Now the then clause has as its verb logidzesto. This is from logidzomai, which means to reckon or regard. And the stho ending sort of gives it away as a middle or passive imperative, right? And this is a third-person imperative. Logizomai is deponent, so it just has an active meaning. Let whoever is doing this, reckon this again. Tuta is the direct object of the verb. From himself, or something like that. And what should he reckon? That, just as autos, he, emphatic, is Christ's, hutos kai hemes, so also are we. See? So, again, rhetorically, Paul is being a little combative here and a little on the confrontational side. So, good. Questions about any of that? Kind of an if-then sentence, which is not too bad. Unless you haven't gotten enough sleep and you lost your lexicon or something. So, all right? Good. Okay, we'll keep going. Verse 8. Eante gar perisoteronte kauchesomai perites exousias hemon heis edoken hakirias eis oikodomein kai uk eis kath aireisen humon uk aiskunthesomai. Here's another conditional sentence. This time uses aeon plus the subjunctive and a future indicative. So the basic sentence is, if I boast, I will not be put to shame. So the verb of the if clause is kaukesomai, and you can see the long omega, the connecting vowel for the subjunctive. If I boast, and then the then clause is quite short, uk aiskunthesomai, I will not be put to shame. Now we've got to figure out all the stuff in the if clause. For if I boast, now we'll take te right in front of it as a direct object, and perisoteron can modify te. If I boast something greater or more abundant, I suppose you could take it as adverbial, if I boast more abundantly. But the sense wouldn't be changed too much. And about what is Paul perhaps boasting? Answer, peri plus the genitive, about our authority, And now let's modify authority with a relative clause, which the Lord gave. And why did he give it? For building and not for tearing down of you. Okay? By the way, that would be, I guess that would be an objective genitive, right? Paul, I don't want to tear you down. My authority that the Lord gave me is actually for building you up, right? God doesn't want me to have to tear you down, right? Now, if you take a look at that peri phrase, we've got peri plus a genitive, about, concerning the authority of us, that would, I suppose, be a possessive genitive or conceivably a subjective genitive, because there is a verb exousiazo. Here's a very a fun, nice point of grammar. It has absolutely no meaning whatsoever, but you get to say something very strange. Heis is a relative pronoun, and it should be accusative because it's the direct object of edoken, which the Lord gave. But there's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful grammatical phrase for describing why it's genitive. Does anybody know what the grammars call this? This is very exciting. It means absolutely nothing. This is called the attraction of the relative pronoun. For those of you listening on the internet, everybody's looking at me as if they wish Greek Club were over. No, I'm quite serious. It is about as or a paragogic nun. That's right. That's right. No, sometimes the relative pronoun will be, this. I swear this is how they say it, it will be attracted to the case of its antecedent. So this is, now, by the way, you think this will never get you anywhere, but if you see Dr. Vels and you tell him that you saw a case of the attraction of the relative pronoun, he will buy you a very nice bottle of wine. He will. Don't you think? No, Reed doesn't think so. Okay. But he'll be happy that you know it. And so will I. Right? So does that mean anything? No. I just felt compelled to point it out. Okay. Anything else about verse 8 of significance or no significance? Just kind of an if-then sentence. Once you get the main verbs of the two clauses, you're in pretty good shape. All right. And now we have this is a little bit difficult. Again, the editors give you some punctuation. Notice how there's a period at the end of verse 8 and then a full stop in the verse 9. The grammars and the commentary suggest that verse 9 is another kind of parenthetical comment. It's just a henna clause. So, hename duxo hus an ek phaben humas diaton epistolon. Now, it doesn't really make sense until you read the rest of it. Where Paul talks about the accusation that when he writes letters, he's very impressive and powerful, but when he's present, he's kind of a wimp. I mean, that's the accusation. But verse 9, if you put a parenthesis around the verse, hiname, negative purpose, lest, this is the aorist subjunctive of dukeo, which means I think, or it can mean I seem. Like, I seem to be a certain way. Lest I seem, hus on, can be translated as if. Lest I seem as if to frighten you through the letters. And the epistolae, right? The letters. So, again, what Paul is setting up is his sort of brief rebuttal of the accusation that, oh, yeah, he writes like a big shot, but when he shows up, he's a pushover. I mean, that's kind of what's going on there. And in order to get that, it would take us too far into the next 5 minutes when we all have to go to class. So we'll stop here after verse 9, and we'll pick up next week. And again, for those listening, next week will be the last week of the term. And so we will meet next week and then take 2 weeks off and I think pretty much continue through the summer more or less. So stay tuned. Thanks a lot.